KRVS.
Coming up next, we're looking at the role economics plays in running a flourishing food and beverage operation. We begin with tech wizard Damian McGavro, who explains the importance of raw data when managing a restaurant.
How often did a server sell appetizers or desserts or a bottle of wine? All of these are critical metrics for managers so they can deliver a magical experience.
Then we speak with Master Sommelier Molly Wismeyer about directing a successful beverage program.
When you work in my team, whether you're serving a $21 bottle or a $21,000 bottle, it will receive the same treatment and respect, and you will make sure the guest sees that.
Money talks, and we're listening on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Relatives are demanding a probe, and an attorney says he will conduct an independent investigation after former NFL star Aaron Hernandez was found hanged in his prison cell early this morning. His death is also evoking protests from an inmate advocacy group in Massachusetts, which says the Department of Correction needs to hire more mental health professionals and mandate prison officials to frequently check in with inmates serving life sentences without the possibility of parole, like Hernandez was. He was incarcerated for the 2013 murder of an acquaintance. He was acquitted just days ago of two other murders. The death of the one-time New England Patriots tight end occurred the same day that athletes from his former team were due to visit the White House to celebrate their Super Bowl victory. Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz will not seek re-election in 2018. The Republican made a national name for himself as head of the House committee that investigated Hillary Clinton's private email server and her role in the circumstances surrounding the 2012 attack on a U.S. diplomatic mission in Benghazi, Libya. Whitney Evans of member station KUER in Salt Lake City reports Chaffetz's unexpected announcement comes at a time when the GOP is stepping up fundraising to protect its majority in Congress.
Chaffetz says in a statement he's made a personal decision to return to the private sector after 8 years in Congress. He says he's long advocated public service should be for a limited time. Chaffetz writes he would consider running for public office again, but not in 2018. As chair of the House Oversight Committee, Chaffetz has been criticized for snubbing Democratic requests to investigate the Trump administration for potential conflicts of interest and links between his campaign and Russia. Chaffetz says he's announcing now to give the party time to find a candidate to replace him. He says he's confident that Utah's 3rd District will be represented by a Republican. For NPR News, I'm Whitney Evans in Salt Lake City.
The Republican Party is already scrambling to keep Democrats from flipping a congressional seat vacated by Republican Tom Price when he became Secretary of Health and Human Services. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina tells NBC's Today Show the special election neighboring Georgia is a wake-up call.
There are districts like this all over the country that are getting much more moderate, and I think Karen will do a good job. She's probably the best Republican we could have chosen.
In a field of 18 candidates, Karen Handel, Georgia's former Secretary of State, made it to the June runoff with 19.8% of the vote. The 30-year-old Democrat she faces, John Ossoff, fared better, but he was still a few points shy of the 50% he needed to claim an outright victory in the special election in Georgia. U.S. stocks are mixed this hour, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 62 points at 20,460. NASDAQ is up 28 points at 5877. S&P up 1 at 2343. This is NPR. More political turmoil today in Germany, where right-wing leader now says she will not run in the upcoming elections. Here's Esme Nicholson.
Franka Petri, co-chair of the Alternative for Germany party, or AfD, announced Wednesday in a Facebook video that she won't be leading their election campaign, neither alone nor as part of a team. Petri's decision reflects the current turmoil among the party's upper ranks, who claim that she has become too mainstream for their anti-immigration and anti-EU ideology. Although the AfD is expected to gain seats in the Bundestag for the first time this September, the party's approval ratings have dropped to single digits compared with 13% a few months ago. Petri did not announce she was stepping down as party leader. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Berlin.
An asteroid is expected to do a flyby for the first time in about 400 years. NPR's Colin Dwyer reports it'll be close enough for small telescopes to pick up, but harmless.
Don't worry.
Astronomers say there is absolutely no chance the asteroid will hit Earth. Still, that doesn't mean it won't be coming close. The object, which is about as big as the Rock of Gibraltar, will be a little over 1 million miles away from Earth at its closest approach on Wednesday. NASA plans to use radar over the next several days to get a better sense of the asteroid's shape and surface features. But don't forget to break out your telescopes, too. This flyby offers a rare opportunity for space watchers. It will be another decade before an asteroid so large is expected to come so close to Earth. Colin Dwyer, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, along with a legacy of putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at RaymondJames.com.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Sometimes it seems everyone harbors a secret longing to become a chef and restaurateur. But according to recent studies nationwide, 60% of all new hospitality ventures fail within the first 3 years. Now, that's a scary statistic. Part of that equation is food cost, which cuts out about 40% of the gross right off the top. Today on Louisiana Eats, we're talking to the masters of creative economic restaurant success. And along the way, we'll learn that hospitality can be hard to measure, but is an essential part of successful restaurant magic. We meet tech wizard Damian McGavro to learn about how his data analytics program has saved many an industry giant from economic peril, even the likes of Danny Meyer and Ralph Brennan. Ralph's vice president, Charlie Williamson, weighs in on the magic Damian worked for their Disneyland operation, Ralph Brennan's Jazz Kitchen. And sommelier Molly Wismeyer deciphers the strategy behind building a multi-million dollar wine cellar that brings in multi-millions in annual returns. Want to open your own restaurant? Stay tuned to learn how on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I'm Damian McGavro. I am the author of The Underground Culinary Tour and founder of Avero.
Author and entrepreneur Damian McGavro has two major passions. One is for data analytics. The other is for the hospitality industry.
I fell in love with the restaurant business at age 16. I was a busboy in Cherry Hill, New Jersey at the Hyatt Hotel and learned one very important lesson. The general manager said to me, if you want to be successful in this business, you need to do one thing. That is exceed guest expectations. And that's something that I've lived my life, you know, with as simple, yet sometimes it can be challenging, you know, in this industry.
While it may seem like the unsentimental world of statistics are at odds with the romance of dining culture, Damian has been able to use his passion to transform the way restaurants conduct their business.
I was a frustrated restaurateur. I would ask my chefs and managers very simple questions like, who are your top and bottom servers? Why'd your food costs go up? Why'd your labor costs go up? And they gave me blank stares and wrong answers. And all the while, they would spend half their time in the back office as opposed to being in the kitchen making great food or on the floor providing great service. And I asked myself, is it just this restaurant group or is it the industry? And it turned out it was both. So what I wanted to do is really solve that problem. And so I brought together a chef, a sommelier, and a restaurant manager with three techies. And together, we created Avero. And out of my studio apartment, grew Avero with a great team. And now Avero is 10,000 restaurants in 70 countries. And it's a software as a service that's used by many of the top restaurants in the industry.
Many of the biggest names in hospitality, such as Danny Meyer and Ralph Brennan, are fans. Damien's new book, The Underground Culinary Tour, explains how restaurants are using his data analysis software to modernize the industry.
The Underground Culinary Tour is the backstory of how our dining experience is being transformed by two big things. First, embracing data and technology. And second, it's the adaptation of trends from the foodie generation. The restaurateurs doing these two things, I call them the New Guard Restaurateur. And this book is really about the magic behind the scenes that makes this all possible. And one of the missing ingredients, an invisible ingredient, is data.
How did you come up with the concept of leading the Underground Culinary Tour? Because, by the way, anybody who thinks, oh, that sounds like a great idea, unless you're the CEO of a large company, you're not likely to come along on the bus, are you?
Well, the Underground Culinary Tour, the book, gets its name from a Underground Culinary Tour that I've hosted with Alice Elliott, a dear friend of mine. And it's essentially, it's 15 stops in 25 hours. And I use New York City as a restaurant laboratory to give restaurant leaders a glimpse of the future. And what I mean by that is trends that used to go from a place like New York or San Francisco or Chicago might take 20 years to get to the rest of the country. But because of technology, social media, foodie cable TV, these trends are now appearing in 6 to 12 months. And that's one of the primary reasons why I started the Underground Culinary Tour, and that's why the book gets its name.
Okay, let me ask you some of the most confounding words I found in the book. What are sabermetrics?
Yes, so the Underground Culinary Tour, think of it as like Moneyball for restaurants. So in the movie Moneyball, it's based upon the book by Michael Lewis. In there, Billy Beane was the general manager of the Oakland A's, and he used scarce resources to really compete against teams that had far greater resources like the New York Yankees. And so the parallel is in the Underground Culinary Tour, it's really Moneyball for restaurants. So instead of a baseball card, which would have runs batted in or on base percentage or home runs, the Avero scorecard actually has, well, how often did a server sell appetizers or desserts or bottle of wine or their table turn time? All of these are critical metrics for managers to better train and target, really mentoring to build confidence so they can deliver a magical experience.
When I read your chapter about theft and loss prevention, now I assumed that restaurants went to a system where the only way the servers were getting food out of the kitchen was by using the point of sale tools that come built in with the cash registers and everything. But you name many, many, many ways that they can circumvent that and steal from the restaurant owner.
Look, theft is an issue with every major industry. And restaurants are no exception to the rule. And the best way to explain the algorithm that we developed is the movie Catch Me If You Can. And in that movie, Leonardo DiCaprio's character is the thief. And it's always three steps ahead of Tom Hanks's character, the FBI director. And so think of this algorithm at Avero that we developed as replacing the Tom Hanks character. And the thing that an algorithm can do that a human cannot is you can go through hundreds of thousands of transactions in seconds. And the algorithm actually steered me towards a particular restaurant, a particular server. and with a colleague, had a great lunch, and which included a Diet Pepsi. When they paid the bill, it turned out that they said the Diet Pepsi was voided out. Meanwhile, I saw my colleague drink the Diet Pepsi, and they also applied an obscure discount as well. So all in all, it was like $6 that didn't end up in the restaurant's bank account. It ended up in the server's bank account. And so one of the things that we see is this idea of micro theft. And it's really manipulating the point of sale for smaller amounts of transactions at higher frequencies. And so that $6 may not seem a lot, but if you look at the data, it was like $5,000 a year. And that is one of the beautiful things about technology is that you can really develop an algorithm that can identify this suspicious behavior.
And so we've name dropped these very high-end glitzy names, but you have also worked with CEOs from Cinnabon and other organizations people may regard as sort of pedestrian.
Well, let me tell you, we are in New Orleans. So imagine we are having brunch at Brennan's, right in the French Quarter at Royal Street. And imagine, you know, it's a beautiful day in the courtyard, and the server, you know, guides us to Egg Sardou, a Cajun, you know, Bloody Mary, and Bananas Foster, a dish that they invented. And we have a memorable experience. But what people don't see is this 70-year-old institution is using data and understanding the patterns to make sure that all the servers are trained to be able to deliver that experience and make sure the kitchen doesn't run out of the ingredients. And that's something that, since we're in New Orleans, I can't say enough about, you know, Ralph Brennan and his team, you know, at Brennan's, and how they are a New Guard restaurateur. You know, even though they're 70, you know, year institution, they continually to innovate. And that's one of the real main messages in the book, is when you embrace data and you constantly evolve, they're the two things about being a New Guard restaurateur.
Explain to us a little bit about how the Ralph Brennan Group came to adopt the data and the technology in order to survive.
You know, they have a great tradition in New Orleans of having phenomenal restaurants, and they wanted to expand to California. And one of the things when they embraced Avero is they were able to see trends that were happening. You know, look, I mean, that market in Disneyland is very different and very far away. And so it's a great lesson for anyone who's expanding out of their home market. The data actually showed that there was really different types of people, you know, coming in, what they were demanding, the price points, how to schedule labor. The data helped them figure out, well, maybe I need to evolve the menu a little bit and not be as, you know, exact same as
yes.
New Orleans. And I just love that, you know, part of the story, because it's, you know, using data to really help when you're growing outside of your home market.
During the time of what I refer to as the time of terrible troubles, our horrible, awful time in 2005 with Katrina, if it hadn't been for your data helping to turn around Ralph's Jazz Kitchen in Anaheim, which frankly, the way it read to me, he might have like pulled up roots and abandoned ship without the assistance of your data collection, that business kept the businesses here in New Orleans running through our time of terrible troubles.
You know, when I interviewed Ralph Brennan and Charlie Williamson, it made me tingle, you know, hearing how data can really change people's lives. And that's really, you know, the spirit of this book. It's not just about numbers. It's really about people and creativity. And I think how the Brennans used the data to really really change their business and really help each other's businesses and markets, which really enabled him to have more resources post-Katrina. I just loved the ability and opportunity to really tell that story.
Well, any time that you have some sort of great technology breakthrough that involves my favorite
world, the hospitality world, give me a ring, would you?
Absolutely. And thanks for the cocktail.
Thank you.
Damian McGavro, founder of Avero and author of The Underground Culinary Tour. Lafayette, Louisiana is often said to have more restaurants per capita than any other city in the U.S. But is this claim true? Stay tuned, and we'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Blind smokestack driving rain.
Acadiana Prescription Shop presents this week's Local Produce Live with the Rayo Brothers. Watch it now online at krvs.org.
I can't get off of this train. Met you at that county line.
Later today on This American Life. You know, Russia's in the news so much these days, and so many of us, me included, still do not know much about it. Like, for instance, did Vladimir Putin come to power by blowing up apartment buildings, killing hundreds of his own people to create a pretext for invading Chechnya? You know that story? We lay out the evidence later today.
Tonight at 7 on KRVS.
Hi, this is Dan Phillips inviting you to Funkify Your Life Thursday afternoons at 1 and Friday nights at 9 right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. It's been said that Lafayette, Louisiana has more restaurants per capita than any other city in the country. But is this claim true? Megan Wyatt, journalist with Lafayette's The Daily Advertiser, did some research to answer this question and published some surprising results. Let's do the numbers. According to Megan's research, Lafayette doesn't even have the most restaurants per capita in the state. With a population of 124,276 and a restaurant count of 445, Lafayette has 3.58 restaurants for every 1,000 residents, ranking it fourth in Louisiana. Ranked third with 3.73 restaurants per 1,000 is Monroe. Baton Rouge is next with 3.9, which brings us to number one. You might think that New Orleans is at the top of our state's list, but as it turns out, with 5.64 restaurants per 1,000 residents, the city of Houma has the most restaurants per capita in Louisiana. Almost 200 altogether, serving a population of 34,000. While New Orleans has far and away the most restaurants in the state, around 1,200 in all, the city's dense population brings our per capita ranking down to a modest number 6. While the myth about Lafayette may not be true, locals can take pride in their city's ranking ahead of Austin, Texas, a city known for drawing tourists to its restaurants. Another food town Lafayette ranks ahead of? New York City. I'm Poppy Tooker, and when it comes to the quality of food in restaurants across our state, there's no contest. You're listening to Louisiana Eats.
Hi, my name is Charlie Williamson, and I'm the Executive Vice President of the Ralph Brennan Restaurant Group.
Embarking on her career with the Ralph Brennan Group directly out of college, Charlie Williamson began as a marketing executive, but soon found her way to the top. In her current position as Executive VP, Charlie oversaw the restaurant group's move towards a more analytical approach to success in the dining room. After a fortuitous meeting with Damian McGavro at a national restaurant show, the Ralph Brennan Group rolled out his software in their California location. That success led them to implement it throughout Ralph's entire restaurant group. We sat down to talk with Charlie about exactly what the benefits of Damian's analytics are. Charlie, I've known you a long time, but I had no idea about the depth and breadth of your restaurant operating knowledge, really, until I read Damian's book. And you all had a full chapter in there, Ralph Brennan and you and all the many things that have happened in your association with Damian. Tell me how you came to meet him.
Damian is one of the brightest, most energetic champions of our industry. And we actually met Damian at the National Restaurant Association show on the show floor, where he was marketing his product, Avero Slingshot, which essentially slings the data from the point of sales systems, which you can find in any restaurant, but it slings every keystroke that goes into that system into a cloud, which then you're able to access via the internet.
Now, everybody is familiar with a POS system. This software, how did it differentiate itself? What did it do for you that the other software didn't?
Well, we adopted this software in 2003, and we started using it at Ralph Brennan's restaurant, Jazz Kitchen, in Southern California.
You know, I think a lot of people like myself might be surprised to learn that there is a Jazz Kitchen in Southern California at Disneyland.
That's right. That is an interesting story, how that restaurant came to be. But to keep it short, it is a 450-seat restaurant spread out over three stories, and it's at the Disneyland Resort in California. It's sandwiched between the two theme parks and three hotels, and we deliver on New Orleans' dual legacies of food and music, and we have been there for 17 years. It's a very successful today operation, but in the early days, it was very scary to be operating 1,800 miles away from New Orleans. Doing business in California is very different than doing business in New Orleans. So the business model is different. The clientele is different. And what we needed at that time was some quantitative data to be able to really understand what was going on in the restaurant when we couldn't be there every night. And so what Damian's software allowed us to do was to look at the restaurant operations from afar and have what was going on not filtered through any human beings, right? You ask the chef, any chef, how did something sell? And they're going to say it sold great.
Sold great.
Sold
great. Everybody
loved it. People loved it. I'm getting great feedback. But when you actually have access to numbers and are able to pull data, you can see you sold five last night. Now, if you only sold 20 dinners last night, five would be 25% of your sales, and that would be amazing. But very often, what feels like a lot isn't a lot to the operation. And so what Damian software allowed us to do was really, from a quantitative perspective, understand what was selling, when it was selling, how our service staff was doing, who was selling what, what day parts were most successful, what sold well on, say, a Tuesday versus a Wednesday. And so it really just, for the first time, enabled that to happen automatically, where you weren't taking a piece of paper and a pencil and figuring it out yourself.
How did it change the front and back of the house?
Right. Well, you know, sometimes there's this effect where once people know somebody is looking, behavior can change just on that alone. So it became pretty apparent to the operation in California that the corporate office was watching. But more so, it's creating a culture around that that says, we're not watching to try to catch you doing something wrong. We're watching you so that we can help you, so that we can support you, so that we can figure out whatever problem there is together. And once that trust was created between operations and New Orleans, what we call corporate New Orleans, we were able to put on the table what our issues were, decide how we were going to solve them, and move forward. But again, what the software did was it provided quantitative information, nothing filtered through human beings. Restaurants run by gut often, and that's part of the beauty of them is, and the inspiration is that they're not so micromanaged and so corporate. In fact, a lot of people don't want to work in a very corporate environment. But at the end of the day, this business operates on such slim margins.
A lot of people, I don't think, realize that. I mean, what is the average margin that the food cost is so high?
That's right. I mean, if you're running more than a 30% food cost, you have problems. And, you know, if there's more than 5% on the bottom line, you're doing really well. And, you know, what we have to realize is that in our restaurants, we have hundreds of employees. And the staff that's in these restaurants, they're putting food on their table. They're paying for their mortgage or their rent. They're sending their children to school. And so decisions are very important. It's, you know, lots of people's livelihoods are attached to it, not to mention the happiness of the guests that we serve and the reputation of the city and all of that good stuff. And so while the data is very unsexy in our industry, you know, the chefs had their moment, the maitre d's had their moment, I don't think the data people, the analysts, are really ever going to have their moment, and that's okay. But we have to respect the data-based business decisions that help operations make smart decisions the first time.
For instance, what did you learn from the server's scorecard?
Right. So the server's scorecard is this amazing tool where you're able to actually look at every server in your lineup and understand what they do well and what their opportunities are. So what you're able to do is filter out automatically the different variables that would make it an apples to oranges comparison. So here's an example. If all my shifts are at lunch and all your shifts are at dinner, your check average is going to be higher than mine because people drink more at dinner than they do at lunch and a lot of other reasons. So Damien software, without any manual manipulation, allows you to segment those variables and then run reporting so that when you're really looking at servers and what their strengths and opportunities are, you're measuring the right variables. And then you're able to do one-on-one coaching and counseling and saying, you know what, your wine sales are $5 behind your peers. Do you think it's, could it be, are you having trouble with the wine knowledge? Are you afraid to offer, or are you afraid to open a bottle of wine so you don't want to sell it?
That's been an issue for you all before. Somebody
that's right.
Who wouldn't admit they didn't know how to open a bottle of wine.
That's right.
That's very stressful for a server.
That's right. And so while, yes, that can be uncovered just by visual observation in the dining room by a manager in a very busy house like Jazz Kitchen, you might not surface that. So really what this data provides us with is the ability to just ask questions. And then you go to the operations team and you say, why? And then you go from there to figure out the solution.
I would suspect that many future employees or newcomers into this arena might regard this as a little bit of Big Brother looking mm-hmm. over your shoulder. When do the employees learn that you all have this system in place? And I know this myself, but how do you get it across to them that this is something that's designed to help everybody, including them?
That's right. Well, the most important thing you can do is show service staff what a raise in the average check means to them. And, you know, they're still in restaurants today, you know, a tip model. And so if your check average goes up, then your tips go up as well. And if we can make that connection with the servers, if we can translate the math, then we can show them how it affects their pocketbook. So that's very effective. The other thing that it allows is a little friendly and healthy competition. Mm-hmm. You know, if you had a little, if you were running a contest to see who could sell the most bottled waters tonight, and you post those results on the office door, you know, people want to win. They want to be competitive and show that they're performing at the top of their game. So that helps too.
Well, Shirley, I am so grateful for you giving us this glimpse behind the scenes at the big operation that the Ralph Brennan restaurants are. Thank you for making the time to sit down with us. And really and truly, after reading Damien's book, I have boundless admiration for your skills, because you are one number cruncher, girl.
Well, it's all about making people happy. Thank you very much.
Charlie Williamson, Executive Vice President of the Ralph Brennan Restaurant Group.
Hi, I'm Danny Meyer, and I'm the founder of Union Square Hospitality Group, and always happy to be in New Orleans, and especially with Poppy.
When it comes to opening successful restaurants with a focus on customer satisfaction, Danny Meyer is peerless in his field. Writer, restaurateur, and CEO of Union Square Hospitality Group, Danny's won a staggering 26 James Beard Awards for his family of New York City restaurants. A hallmark of his success is Danny's gold standard of hospitality. We had the honor of sitting down with Danny to hear his thoughts about what's truly important in creating a successful restaurant business.
Well, the thing that we've learned through the years is that the one thing you can train for is how to identify people who have the natural gift for hospitality. But we've never learned how to train people who don't have the natural gift for hospitality how to have it. So what we've been able to do is to identify five or six emotional skills that are almost always present at a very high level in somebody who's got what we call a high HQ, high hospitality quotient. And that's somebody who's, regardless of what their job is, whether they're a bartender or a grill cook or a maitre d', they've got to be really good at what they do. But more importantly, someone with a high HQ is coming to work concerned about how they're making someone else feel. And yeah, they want to be the best at what they do, but they come from a spirit first and foremost of, okay, when I'm doing that thing I do so well, how did I make the person on the receiving end feel? And we've gotten pretty good at identifying what the emotional skills are that are always present. And we do know how to teach that. The first one is someone who is kind and optimistic. You would be surprised how skepticism and negativity and the glass is half empty does not work in hospitality. So you want optimism and you want someone who's kind. Secondly, you want somebody who is really curious about learning. Somebody asks good questions like you do. Somebody who walks a different street every day just because they might just learn something new. Third, you want somebody who's got a great work ethic. We do know how to teach people how to do their job, the stuff they do pretty well, but we don't know how to teach people how to care about doing it as well as it can possibly be done. And then fourth, we look for people who are enormously empathetic, people who are aware of the wake that they leave in their path when they go through life, and who care about how they make other people feel. That's sort of an obvious one. And they care how other people feel. And then the next one is self-awareness. We want people who realize that just like the weather changes every single day, we all wake up feeling slightly differently every single day, and we want people who are aware of what's going on inside of them, because hospitality is a team sport, and it's really important to know how your own emotional weather report is going to make other people feel. And then the sixth one, which is so hugely important, is integrity. And that's somebody who has the judgment to do the right thing even when no one else is looking. So I know that sounds like an awful lot right there, but if you had someone who was the best pasta maker in the world and yet they weren't nice, I don't want to hire them. Or if you had somebody who's the best grill cook in the world but they don't have a great work ethic, I don't want to hire them. On the other hand, if you get someone who's awesome at what they know how to do and who's doing it because they want the product of their work to make you feel better than you otherwise felt, that works every single time. You just can't lose. I think that when we go to work, it's really with a spirit of what's called servant leadership. And everyone knows that I'm the boss of the company, but I also realize that my highest order of responsibility is to create a work environment that makes work feel like you're coming to play. And therefore, my job is to serve our employees so they can do an even better job of serving our guests.
Another fascinating aspect of your business to me is that, so you've got these great employees and you're an incredible leader for those employees, but over the years, you have so drastically diversified your businesses from a very, very fine dining white table Union Square to a Shake Shack or a Blue Smoke, all those different elements. What made you go from one point to another? What made you do that stretch?
So you're asking a great question, Poppy. And, you know, I've actually spoken to business consultants who have asked that question in a way that makes me feel like I'm doing something wrong. Because, in wise business circles, you should really have the discipline to focus on doing one thing that you do better than anybody else as well as you can do it. And I finally came up with a good answer for myself. I don't really care if I satisfy them. And that's that we only do one thing. And the one thing we do is hospitality. And the fun is, and in fact, my passion is to test out, is the power of hospitality so strong that you can actually leverage it over all kinds of different businesses? And at the same, for example, I would say if you take a company like Heinz, which is famous for 57 varieties, do they have 57 different businesses or do they have one business that has 57 different ways of expressing that one real mission of the company? And so I think that in our case, we love our restaurants that have stars in the New York Times and Michelin, high ratings in the Zagat survey. But it's equally satisfying to see that at any price point, with any menu, and with any mood, people want to feel like you're happy to see them and they want to feel welcome. And it's really fun to play that one business out over many, many different ways of expressing it.
My baby don't care for rings or other expensive things. My baby just cares for me.
How do you wring big bucks out of water? When we return, sommelier Molly Wismar will share her magic and pour some wine as well. Stay tuned.
His baby don't care for shows. His baby don't care for clothes.
My baby just cares for me.
Nobody else will do.
This is Bob Gusherow inviting you to tune in to the music of yesteryears every Tuesday night at 7. We'll listen to music from the great composers from the first part of the last century, done by performing artists then and the contemporaries of today, with a variety of music from my library and the library of many of my friends. That's the music of yesteryears, Tuesday nights at 7, right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Bob Dylan's songs are part of American consciousness, with sources in blues and ballads, ancient and modern poetry, the beauties and absurdities of life, love, and loss. Dylan's contributions to the big river of song are many. It's How Many Roads, Bob Dylan's Back Pages, on American Roots from PRX.
Friday afternoon at 1, right after the Blues Box on KRVS.
tired of the same old radio show? Well, join me Thursdays at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time for La Bellonera Latin Caribbean Music for Acadiana here on KRBS 88.7. Mami, que rico!
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and Brennan's Restaurant. Breakfast at Brennan's, featuring Chef Slade Rushing's updated classic Creole cuisine. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, and private events at 417 Royal Street in the historic French Quarter.
Hi, I'm Molly Wismeyer. I'm a sommelier located here in New Orleans. I guess you would say a beverage professional.
A thriving restaurant business is usually supported by a successful beverage program. To get a better understanding of what a beverage program is and how it operates, we sat down with award-winning sommelier Molly Wismeyer. Molly shared with us her insider's perspective on how restaurants can build beverage menus that please palates and pad profits.
Yes, the beverage program definitely brings in revenue and it definitely brings in profit. And I do have to confess, when I am creating these beverage programs, I am more motivated by the opportunity to create something and to create a team and to be a part of a team, all the while hoping that then the outcome is that there is profit. So having said that, I have been blessed and very fortunate to work under many great chefs. The reason that people do go to restaurants is for the food and for the chef. So it's this wonderful balance when you work with really great chefs who recognize what the beverage program can add to their vision. And one theme that runs through them all is that many people refer to the business that we're in as an industry. And that is one, if anyone's worked with me out there and you're listening, they know what I'm about to say, which is we are not an industry when you work in the restaurant business. We don't create widgets. We create experiences. And we're directly tapped into our senses. And our number one job is to do that with people. So why do I bring this up? Because that's where I start. I usually sit at a desk or in my space when I'm creating a wine list and I'm thinking, okay, so how big is this wine list going to be? How many selections is it going to be? Where am I going to be? What part of the country, since I've been in other parts of the country? So culturally, I need to think about what do people already want and then what am I going to entice them with? Because you want to have a sense of familiarity for people when you create a wine list. And to go back a little bit and talk about the professionalism again, that all ties in into my philosophy and my thinking as to how I'm going to train people. So when you train people very, very well to understand your vision, whatever it is, if you're the beverage person, then they will be able to translate your vision and your strategy into service to people. So when they approach the guest, they're going to know every single wine by the glass, and that's what you have to do. You have to train your team so that they know every single wine by the glass, and they can explain it to people, and they can translate it to people. Because if you put something like an unfamiliar wine, let's say a white Portuguese, on there, and it's only $8 a glass, but people don't know what it is, even if you list it, then you create a barrier already to people. And the beverage person has to be comfortable with themselves and with their ability to train the team to translate into giving that guest that really great service.
What is it that you do to transmit that information, to have them become that person that you want them to be on the floor?
when people work with me, they've read the training manual, to sound boring, but really you create this training manual and you create a story of the vision that you want to have. So in my training manuals, I told them the story of what I just shared, that we're not in an industry, we're in a business. And when you work in my team and with me and for the chefs, you are working as a professional. So what does that mean? That means that you will know, and I mean this directly to when it, in regards to beverages, you will know exactly what is a Sazerac, where does it come from, its history, how it pertains, because we're in New Orleans, mm-hmm. Why is that important? It's a part of history, was created here in this city, and it's on almost every single beverage list. So that's one example of a cocktail. For wine, back to that white Portuguese. You know, if you're going to put it on there, then you need to have something recognizable like Pinot Grigio as well. But just because it's Pinot Grigio and it's recognizable and most people know what it is, they still need to know where does that Pinot Grigio come from? Because depending on where Pinot Grigio comes from is going to relate to its price and its quality. Then I taste, all the wines are tasted with the team. They're given descriptions. And it's shared within a team environment so that different people can describe it different ways, because I don't always have the correct description for it, because the team must taste the wine and be able to recognize it and describe it. That's how you translate it.
One of the things that I was really fascinated about at your most recent project at Restaurant Revolution, what is that wine cellar worth?
It's several million.
Several million dollars.
It's
a lot of money.
Yes.
It is almost, in essence, like that wine cellar is a way to have a savings account with dividends, because just because it's in your wine cellar doesn't mean necessarily that one day you're going to sell it to on the floor of the restaurant to a customer. You might actually sell it in another way. Explain how that works.
If a restaurant chooses, if it's lucky enough to stay open after 5 years, 10 years, let's say 15 years or 20 years, a wine that was bought 5, 10, 15, 20 years previously, these are let's call them iconic wines. Red Bordeaux, Chateau Margaux, Red Italian, Sessicaia, it's a super Tuscan. These are all wines that will increase with value in time because of market demand. And they are highly priced when you first buy them. So the likelihood of selling them when you first get them is low. So if the restaurant is fortunate enough to stay open 5 and 10 years, yes, they could choose to sell it to an auction or to the market, let's say. And usually you'll get a return at least a 3x markup, at least. Sometimes I have seen wines that you buy, or other restaurants where I've worked, they've been open 20 years, 100x markup.
Wow.
Might have been able – well, some Bordeaux people bought 40 years ago for 10 or 15 a bottle, and they can sell for 10,000. But that doesn't happen every day, and that is definitely something that it becomes rarer and rarer, because – the exchange of information is much faster now because of our technology, and more people know about the value right away. And less people have the ability to keep, let's say those wines usually cost anywhere at cost to buy for a restaurant. The previous wines I mentioned would start at restaurant cost, wholesale cost, at $1,000 a bottle. So not a lot of restaurants have that kind of capital just to buy it and keep it around for 20 years. When you have a cellar, and I'm putting those in quotes, the chefs and the people who own it have made that commitment to make that kind of investment. And you do get a certain kind of built-in marketing from that. People will start to notice it, and that word of mouth will circulate. And usually, when the person who's running the beverage program, the team, the chef, awards will start to come, and that's that, you know, that wonderful, you know, national marketing that comes that helps to pay for those bottles that sit there for a few years.
Nowadays, and I can only imagine that this is a phenomenon that may have occurred during your career, water is an integral part of a beverage program.
Yes.
Talk to me about water.
What you're doing in fine dining in certain circumstances in restaurants is you are creating this experience. So bottled water coming from a very fine source, the best. I was like, okay, I guess that falls in with you're going to have the best foie gras, or you're going to have the best chicken au poulard or poulet, or you're going to have the best meat. I mean, that really happened probably within the past 10 years within the restaurant business. I'm not saying it's necessary. And for me, I was always very apprehensive. And my take on that was if we're going to charge for bottled water and we had special bottled water brought in for Revolution, and then we also ordered had San Pellegrino, so we had a couple options. I wanted different price points and always made sure that our tap water or in-house filtered water was the verbiage we used. The service was really great. I went out of my way to train the team of we poured it out of – we had glass bottles that had an R, that have an R on the Revolution, and it was filtered. And, you know, that was free. And that got paid more attention to actually than the bottled water service. Okay. And I wanted it to be that way because when something costs a lot of money, there's an expectation that's already built in that you're going to get treated a certain way because of that. So I always try to train my team when something doesn't cost a lot of money – that's when you're really going to pay attention and give really great service to that particular aspect of the meal, because service needs to come from your heart and it needs to be gracious and it needs to be sincere. You don't give great service just because something costs a lot. You give great service because you want to serve people. And that was a big part of my training. And I'm like, we're not here just to sell $3,000 bottles of wine. We're here also to sell a $21 bottle, because that's what I had. I had up to $21 to $21,000 on the list.
Wow.
And I trained them that whether you're serving a $21 bottle or a $21,000 bottle, it will receive the same treatment and respect, and you will make sure the guest sees that.
Master Sommelier Molly Wismeyer. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, from Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef in New Orleans French Quarter. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, or see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.